I hope those of you who already know the biographical facts, the few facts of Judge's exterior life which are known, will bear with me if I introduce this with just a page or two about his life. William Quan Judge passed away 100 years ago, leaving a legacy of selfless service to mankind. He presented the teachings of theosophy to America in clear and simple terms, which all levels of seekers might understand. A modest man, his life intoned the keynote, "Thus have I heard." Born in Dublin, Ireland, on April 13, 1851, William Q. Judge survived a near-death event at the age of 7. His character changed from a prosaic boy into one interested in mystical subjects. It was as if he were embodied by a more advanced entity, which gradually took over his Irish body, although he always said it was a struggle to master it. His father immigrated to New York in 1864 with 7 motherless children. Judge became a naturalized citizen in 1872 and was admitted to the State Bar of New York in the same year. In 1874, he married Ella Smith, a young school teacher, with whom he had 1 daughter who died in infancy. During August of 1875, he met H.P. Blavatsky and was a frequent visitor at her residence. Not only was he among the chief founders of the Theosophical Society, but he also had several opportunities to contribute to the writing and production of Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine. After H.P.B. and Colonel Olcott left for India in 1879, Judge endured years of hardship developing a small group of students in America. At times, in order to keep the New York Center alive, he addressed an empty room. Eventually, his work bore fruit as numerous lodges spread across the nation. From 3 branches chartered in 1883, their numbers grew to 105 by 1895. His Path magazine was inaugurated in the same year the American section was formed, 1886. Stemming from an idea of printing nationwide lodge contributions, Judge started his tract mailing scheme in 1887. By 1892, over 500,000 tracts had been issued. No longer despairing of the lack of direction from Colonel Olcott in India, Judge accepted his role as resuscitator of theosophy in America and saw his isolation from the other founders as a test of his devotion to the cause. In The Irish Theosophist, Bertram Keatley refers to HBB's remark about Mr. Judge as the exile. Annie Besant wrote later on, "You are indeed fortunate in having WQJ as chief. Now that HPB has gone, it is the Americans who have, as immediate leader, the greatest of the exiles." An early issue of The Theosophist bears Judge's signature, an ex-Asiatic, identified by HPB in her editorial footnote. Judge wrote of his sojourn by day in a Western body and by night in an Eastern Hindu body in Letters That Have Helped Me, the book that Vonda gave yesterday. A man who never exiled anyone out of his heart, in the year 1890, when Colonel Olcott first considered resigning as president of the society, Judge upheld his brother co-founder, insisting that Olcott remain at the helm. Successfully building up the U.S. lodges, Judge became a hero for his compatriots in Ireland as well. Perhaps you've heard of the Irish literary renaissance and are aware of the poems and work of William Butler Yeats and George Russell, who wrote under the pen name of A.E., and he wrote a wonderful tribute after Judge's passing called Hero of the Iron Age. Well, even in those days, students gathered in malls because addressing a gathering of Dublin students at Charlemont Mall in 1888, he described the method of study adopted in America. Each branch, he said, formed itself into sections for the purpose of studying a certain subject, such, for instance, as the Bhagavad Gita. When the study was completed, the sections compared notes and produced subsequently a general statement of decisions upon which they could all agree. Without such a system adopted as this, the movement could not have solidarity. Moreover, it was the system adopted by groups of chelas under the direct supervision of the masters. Although many other fine translations and commentaries upon the Bhagavad Gita exist, today, William Q. Judge's rendition, published in 1890, is still treasured by theosophists. At that time, there were only a few translations. This man, whose writings bore the seal of modesty and occult understanding, was upheld by HPB as a man who has ever been true to the masters. She called him the Antakarana, link between East and West. He was appointed her sole representative for the esoteric section of the Theosophical Society in America. After HPB's death, his health suffered from Chagres fever, which is a form of malaria, picked up in South America as a youth. He died at the young age of 45 on March 21st, 1896. Judge wrote very little about himself, but a number of fine tributes by fellow students appeared in Theosophy magazine in the months following his death. To quote from one by Mr. G. Hijo, while staying with us in the country in 1894, he would take me out for a 15 or 20 minutes walk just before bedtime, and when in a talkative mood, would describe to me the things he then saw interiorly, elementals of all kinds, pictures in the astral light, some trivial, some interesting, and in the nature of prophetic visions. He told me that the master quite frequently informed him of important matters by means of allegorical pictures, as one picture would contain as much information as pages of a letter or message. And he described how he could tell these pictures from those of an ordinary astral character. Such allegorical images are sensed while reading Judge's telltale picture gallery. The reader feels that he's walking through its open starlit corridors with the author. The story takes place in ancient Ireland, near a temple where roamed the, quote, wandering eye of a fellow disciple, now deceased. Here, Judge wrote, were the living pictures of every student or priest of the order founded by the adepts of the Diamond Mountain. These vitalized pictures were connected by invisible cords with the character of those they represented. And like a telegraph instrument, they instantly recorded the exact state of the disciple's mind. When he made a complete failure, they grew black and were destroyed. When he progressed in spiritual life, their degrees of brightness or beauty showed his exact standing. As these conclusions were reached, louder and stronger musical tones filled the hall. Directly before me was a beautiful, peaceful face. Its brilliance outshone the light around, and I knew that some unseen brother had reached some height of advancement that corresponded to such tones. While most of Judge's occult tales were set in Ireland, one in particular transpired during a mining trip to South America, where he had hoped to gain enough money to dedicate his whole time to theosophy. Called A Weird Tale, it takes place in Caracas, Venezuela. There, he meets a Hindu who later appears sometimes in a white Indian dhoti, and at others in European dress. Judge hears the stranger's voice as if it were speaking through a pipe from an immense distance in space. This method of adept communication is mentioned in the Mahatma Letters number 8. Returning to Caracas, Judge could not relocate the dwelling on the narrow streets where he had first seen the stranger. But later in London, he sees him again. One of the elemental shapes he is shown has nearly a human visage. It seeks a copy of an Egyptian papyrus Judge had in New York, showing the trial of the dead. Regretting its absence, Judge suddenly sees it appear upon the table in his Hindu guide's apartment. It seems to attract a flock of airy elementals. One of these ripples its surface as if examining the peculiar animal figures of jackals, cats, and birds. His host describes their symbolic meaning. For the modern theosophist, a treasure trove lies in Judge's practical writings. From its inception in 1886 until the year of his passing, The Path magazine held his editorials and articles under various pen names. 100 years later, these are still available in a 3-volume series, Echoes of the Orient, published by Point Loma, and available here in your bookstore, I might add, or in United Lodge of Theosophists' 2-volume series. Mr. Judge's early articles are a preliminary course for the esoteric section, closing volume 3 of Echoes of the Orient. One of them, An Epitome of Theosophy, helps students look into the soul's experience and the mind of the universe. The epitome distills key teachings of karma, reincarnation, evolutionary time periods, the life of man as a pilgrimage, his sevenfold nature, and the Akasha, that indelible record of all man does here on earth. Reflecting upon William Kwan Judge's writings, all contain his hallmark of theosophy simply stated. Our Point Loma title is based on a newspaper series in Kate Fields, Washington, known as Echoes from the Orient, a title chosen, Judge stated, because, quote, no one writer could do more than to repeat some of the echoes reaching his ears. The first echo from the burnished, mysterious East, which reverberated from these pages, sounded the note of universal brotherhood, close quote. His Path magazine was christened with similar words. The very first step in true mysticism and occultism is universal brotherhood, without which the very highest progress in the practice of magic turns to ashes in the mouth. Brotherhood is the imperative, then, especially since America is in a perpetual ferment, preparing for a new stage in human development known as the sixth sub-race. That blending of all races coming together here requires the catalyst of universal brotherhood to be firmly established. The social and ethnic strife seen today shows how far we have to go to reach the ideal community. The ocean of theosophy refers to this impact. As the units in nation and race are connected together by invisible, strong threads, large bodies of such units moving slowly but surely all together reunite at different times and emerge again and again together into new race and new civilization as the cycles roll their appointed rounds. Therefore, The souls who made the most ancient civilizations will come back and bring the old civilization with them in idea and essence, which being added to what others have done for the human race in its character and knowledge, will produce a new and higher state of civilization. The Ocean of Theosophy just quoted from is a basic text issued in 1893, previously appearing as a series of articles for the Fort Wayne Sentinel. A mystic dialogue, The Eternal Pilgrim and the Voice Divine, was sent once by Judge as General Secretary to his T.S. Lodges as a gift. It states, a fervent thought sent round for the well-being of humanity is worth more than kingdoms. Reminding members that regardless of beliefs, a theosophist can be in good standing as long as he or she tries to practice universal brotherhood. That respect for the unity of life is our only imperative. Brotherhood being a major theme infusing all his works, what other ideas particularly come into focus in these lectures, articles, and letters? Joining the current of basic theosophy are the paramount themes of practical occultism, altruism, mysticism, the masters, esotericism, and meditation. What is practical occultism? Today, the word occultism has been used very loosely and often includes psychic powers hungrily sought for not just by the gullible or superstitious, but by businessmen and entertainers living life in the fast lane. For them, practical means pragmatic, how to gain power and influence people. What is occultism in Judge's viewpoint? Now, here's one of those one-liners. It turns out he's actually quoting HPB, but you mentioned those one-liners, Wanda. Occultism is the science of the relation of the mind of man to the mind of the universe. Always warning students to be aware of the lure of psychism, of all the fascination with various occult powers, he continued, the first step in occultism is to adapt your thoughts to your plastic potency. It is an epitome of the science of thought. Dynamic thought, he proceeds to demonstrate, can impress the atomic substance of the ether with our mental pictures. To quote, every one of those energic emissions or processes which we call a thought does mold the subtle matter of the ether into etheric form. Such forms are held together by the formative power or plastic potency of the soul substance, just so long as the thought energy inheres in them. The pictures inhere in the mental sphere of each of us, and the sphere is dense, turbid, contractive, or shows all the brightness of the higher vibration according to the nature of these thought forms, which not only act outwardly, but also react upon their creators. The importance of regulating our thoughts in view of the plastic potency of the soul and its imaginative power hence becomes important. How is this practical, you might ask? Mental images are projected daily by radio and television, encroaching upon our lives in the material planes. If they can be misused, there must also be a beneficial use. Do we find ourselves the victims of such impressions, or do we impress fresh, positive mental images on the ether as we venture through the last years of our high-tech 20th century? For instance, how can we use the internet superhighway to elevate the imagination? In the passing lane of the electronic highway, can we convey only positive messages and influences rather than gossip or slander? Do we plant seeds of new ideas to alleviate the sufferings of formerly isolated individuals now reached through cyberspace? How do we mold our own plastic potency to the Buddhic influence of our higher nature? 14 rules of occultism attributed to Mr. Judge are listed in Echoes Volume 3, stemming directly from the Raja Yoga tradition. One of the most important of these is, occultism is not speaking of the faults of others, but charity. Altruism is a common theme to all Judge writes about occultism. It is a plea for ethics based on a rational idea of man. Remember, we are using the term man for monastic being, which of course, meaning the mind, includes women. Altruism must be the line of our lives. We must live what we know, he urges. Altruism offers a gentle lift to the word duty. As chairman of the second annual convention of the TS European section, William Q. Judge gave the closing address in July of 1892. He spoke of the great mass of the common people with which we deal. For our message does not come only for the scholar or scientific man. In spite of scholars, in spite of science, the superstitions of the people live on. And perhaps those very superstitions are the means of preserving to us the almost forgotten truth. Were Judge alive today, how his old Irish mystic heart might gladden to the homage paid to folk wisdom and fairy belief by folklorists and cultural anthropologists. His address went on, "Our duty is to recognize the great human soul with which we have to deal and for which we should work. Its progress, its experience, its inner life are vastly more important than all our boasted civilization. That civilization could easily be swept away, and what would be left? What then could remain save the human experience, the experience of the soul? But no cataclysm can destroy your thoughts. They live on, and so all the work that you do for the inner life of man can meet with no destruction. Even though records and books and all the ingenious works upon this outer plane are swept out of existence." Parallel to altruism, states Judge, is high aspiration. That, quote, heat of spiritual aspiration which acts at once on the inner bodies of the soul. High aspiration, right act, and right thought are the means of progress which eventually carry man to the spiritual sun within. To keep aspiring, even when we sense failure, shows we are moving towards our goal. Judge's use of mystic themes is seen in the above-mentioned dialogue sent as a personal gift to Lodges. Is a gem of similes and metaphors. A voice divine tells the eternal pilgrim to cease its wanderings after the unreal and instead search within. For, quote, space is the ever-living robe of the eternal self. This boundless seeming void is saturated with thought. Invisible, ineffable, wingless phoenixes, ever dying, ever living, of waves upon waves of humanity that have come and gone from the myopic theater of life. We also glean the mystic Judge in several occult tales written under the Irish pen name of Brian Canavan. In them, we sense that suffering which purifies the heart as gold is refined by fire. We fathom there man's thoughts brooding in space from time immemorial. The old Irish round towers rise up again through the mists over Celtic lakes and seas. In a poem by Judge are the lines, "The way lies through the heart. Ask there and wander not. Within, the master's messengers have waited patiently. That master is thyself." Yet, he also encouraged devotion to the lodge of masters. Masters advised, "If we are ignored, we cannot help. Tell the members of the necessity, force, value, and result of proclaiming their belief when held in the lodge and the masters as ideals and facts." For masters are a natural function of evolution and live in the plane of our inner nature. In his letters that have helped me, Judge states, "The masters are anxious that as many as possible may reach to that state of power and love they are in. Why then suppose they help not? As they are Atman and therefore the very law of karma itself, they are in everything in life and in every phase of our changing days and years." An essential thing to remember here is Judge's labor for theosophy, humanity, and the masters. That selfless work is evidence to this student, at least, of his occult connection. Read his own words about masters, for instance, his account of dwellers on high mountains. He speaks there of the Tibetan legend of a sacred mountain where the great souls meet to commune and gain a spiritual clarity from those vantage points, free from the tainted emanations which exist in the cities of men. In January of 1884, due to attacks on KH in the Religio-Philosophical Journal, Judge declares to the editor that he knew of and heard from Kuthumi in New York from the year 1875 to date. Judge goes on to assert to the editors that in India there are thousands who know him. Later, the Eastern School was treated to an unusual letter from an Indian brother who met a Brahmin yogi known as K.B. Swamiji. This yogi had contacted one member of the Himalayan Circle of Masters who had sent HPB to the West in India. While knowing little about the society before going to the Himalayas, this yogi returned with a sense of the mission and destiny of the Theosophists in India. His remarkable description of the Mahatma's electrifying appearance is well worth reading, particularly as he showed his Indian brother a white scar from the magnetic force of a touch from the Master. What else can we learn of the adepts from Judge? In his Ocean of Theosophy, he states, "The most intelligent being in the universe, man, has never then been without a friend, but has a line of elder brothers who continually watch over the progress of the less progressed, preserve the knowledge gained through eons of trial and experience, and continually seek for opportunities of drawing the developing intelligence to consider the great truths concerning the destiny of the soul. In some periods, they are well known to the people and move among ordinary men whenever the social organization, the virtue, and the development of the nations permit it. For if they were to come out openly and be heard of everywhere, they would be worshipped as gods by some and hunted as devils by others." You remember those one-liners Vonda mentioned earlier. I've often thought how, when feeling rather alone and deserted on the path of life, this first sentence of this quote, The most intelligent being in the universe, man, has never been without a friend. How that often that statement comes to mind. Judge had such a friend in HPB. His link with the chain of elder brothers beyond her in stature. In his own words, "It was her eye that attracted me, the eye of one whom I must have known in lives long passed away. She looked at me in recognition at that first hour, and never since has that look changed. It was as if the evening before we had parted, leaving yet to be done some detail of a task taken up with one common end." The years of HPB's sojourn in London marked the most intense HPB judge correspondence. One letter, postmarked May 10, 1887, enclosed another to judge from an adept, some believe, to be Hilarion. John Coates quoted most of it at Orcas Island in 1976. Here is a portion of it. "You say you are a sad case, and yet you have in your heart so great a love for humanity and for the individual members of the race that you are haunted night and day by thoughts of their suffering, ignorance, and pain. It is such as you who hold the human race from falling into that bottomless pit of emptiness where despair is forgotten and where effort is unknown. My dear friend, for that you are, being truly the friend of all who are looking for the light. Lean, I pray you, in thought and feeling, away from these external problems which you have written down in your letter. Draw on the breath of the great life throbbing in us all, and let faith, which is unlearned knowledge, carry you through your life as a bird flies in the air undoubtingly." William Q. Judge writes in an epitome to theosophy, pardon me, an epitome of theosophy, "All future events are the thoughts and acts of men. These are producers in advance of the picture of the event which is to occur. Ordinary men, continually, recklessly, and wickedly, are making these events sure to come to pass. But the sages, Mahatmas, and the adepts of the good law make only such pictures as are in accordance with divine law, because they control the production of their thought." We should point out that the esoteric commentary in Echoes is drawn from an unpublished collation of private instructions known as the Eastern School of Theosophy Suggestions and Aids. Why, you may ask, have we provided this esoteric material, these once secret papers? Largely because this is an age which has broadcast many wild practices regarding meditation and esotericism, to the point of their being plastered everywhere. While HPB protected esoteric teachings by not putting anything potentially dangerous into written instructions, it is evident that today all kinds of abuses have occurred. Similar but misleading teachings have filtered down from groups far more extreme than theosophical ones. Neophytes in theosophy need these warnings, often coming to it with many confused notions about occultism. This bountiful commentary simply augments what has been in print for nearly a century and has been most completely presented in volume 12 of the Blavatsky Collected Writings, compiled by Boris de Zirkov. If you have volume 12, you may want to compare many explanations given in this commentary. The page numbers from volume 12 were inserted into the Echoes text to make comparison easier. In these suggestions and aids, Judge further provides clues to occult learning in the secret doctrine passages. These go beyond the notes produced in Echo's Volume 2, known as Hidden Hints in the Secret Doctrine. Here, WQJ provides a concise esoteric delineation of man's inner principles, while dropping the physical body as part of the sevenfold man of exoteric writings. The dweller on the threshold is defined, and Antahkarana is explained most fully here. His discussion of Padmapani, the great sacrifice, an issuer of the vast tree of adepts, enriches our comprehension of Buddhism. Much of the true nature of buddhi-manas is elaborated here. Judge writes, "Manas joined to buddhi is self-consciousness. When consciously united with buddhi and atma, it becomes divine consciousness. Joined to kama and earth life, it becomes personal consciousness." The last theme I wish to share with you is that of meditation. The esoteric teachings offered in Echoes insist on the importance of meditation, even if only for 5 minutes per day. It is a must in occultism, as the guru, writes Judge, is only the adjuster. To meditate, one must first develop concentration, which he defined as the entire life tendency to a given end. It requires a single thread of devotion, though not always the same method. He describes three basic elements of meditation. One is self-examination, which results in our becoming less critical of others. Secondly, meditation provides a refuge from worldly things and reactivates our inner forces, since it is the cessation of active external thought. Above all, it is aspiration towards our higher self, our buddhic light. This requires discipline, a term which may go against the Western grain. But we have to win our immortality. As so often, we are reminded in the teachings. In no other way can we acquire spiritual will. Very little is written about willpower in exoteric papers, but clues are given both by HPB and Judge, which you may recall in their dialogue Conversations on Occultism. An endorsement of Raja Yoga along these lines is encapsulated in Mr. Judge's rendition of Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, published in 1889. But only in the esoteric section can we find rules for discipleship, more advanced practices, as well as the correct pronunciation of the word Om, and the dangers of using it in anger or for revenge or personal gain. Many are the newspaper accounts of Mr. Judge's travels. A handful were culled for Echoes of the Orient, Volume 3. Working tirelessly, Judge built up the branches in the United States, facing both internal and external pressures. It is hard to believe that he took the advice of his own last spoken words, "Hold fast, go slow." A newspaper announcement of his passing on March 21st appeared on the front page of the Morning Advertiser on March 26, 1896. The headline read, "By Astral Hand, William Q. Judge's Deathbed Message." Mr. Claude Falls Wright stated there, "It was a solemn scene, and one I shall never forget. The soul was about to leave its earthly tenement and the president's hand was utterly powerless. But as the serenity of what is called death was settling on his features, we all observed a slight fluttering among the papers that lay on the table beside his bed. Turning our eyes in that direction, what was our astonishment to see the hand of a man, a white, delicate hand, write several lines on the blank page of a book, the title of which is The Ocean of Theosophy. I would like to close this talk with WQJ's deathbed message, written by his astral hand and rarely seen in print since the spring of 1896. There is no room for sorrow in the heart of him who knows and realizes the unity of all spiritual beings. While people, monuments, and governments disappear, the self remains and returns again. The wise are not disturbed. They remain silent. They depend on the self and seek their refuge in it. Thank you for the opportunity of being here. Yes?
General, what are some other titles of judges' writings and books?
Well, mostly he wrote feverishly in his Path magazine articles. I learned recently that because he had to work, he was always poor, and he paid a lot of money just to keep his path going. So he was a lawyer during the day, and I learned he wrote all night long. But The Ocean of Theosophy is his basic textbook. The Bhagavad Gita I mentioned earlier does have some notes. Now, ULT includes with the first six chapters, I believe, that Judge analyzes, six or seven. They include Robert Crosby's notes, and the Altadena edition limits just to the Bhagavad Gita and what they call combined with essays on the Gita. Also, he did his own rendition of Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. He issued some Oriental departmental papers. He was very eager to get an Indian pandit over to the United States. He kept saying, Alcott, please send me someone here who can write here on the spot, who knows both theosophy and the Indian text. So for a while that did go on, but it's very hard to find that collection. He also has the annual convention and proceedings, which I think you can find in most libraries. The Path magazine is out of print. That's why we did our Echoes series and why ULT does their Theosophical Articles series. But you will find the Path magazine with many other articles by fellow students, such as Jasper Niemand in the Path. Let me think if I've included everything here. He didn't write a lot of books, really. Mostly lectures, articles. He wrote letters. It's hard to believe sometimes. I've seen cases where he's written like a dozen letters per day to people to keep up the work around the United States. Let's see if there's anything I've overlooked here. Oh, of course, letters that have helped me, but that was compiled by Jasper Niemand, you see. However, we speak to Judge there. Like, you can open that book in time of trouble, and it seems like anywhere you open it, you do get help. TUP, that's the Theosophical University Press, has published Practical Occultism. Those are some more letters. That the subtitle is From the Private Letters of William Q. Judge, and it was edited by Arthur L. Conger in 1951. Hopefully they will in time do more, because some of those letters were just everyday type, but others, there are gems in that collection too. But to my mind, nothing can equal letters that have helped me. And his occult tales have been printed separately in book form along with HPB's occult tales. But we included them in our volume of Echoes so that some of these scattered items, like his questions and answers in the forum, it's true, ULT has isolated only those questions that Judge directly answers in their book, which is still in print. The old Theosophical Forum is out of print. However, we included most of them, and some which we felt had his stamp, say, similar in his style. And I believe I've touched on most of them. The Department of Branch Work, designed to assist lecturers and students, were papers issued by the Aryan Press, and they now can only be found in Theosophical Archives. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Did he live on the spot that we're in right now?
No. That time, no. This center was not formed till well after his passing. No, most of his work was centered in New York. He always longed to go to India. That's why he worked so hard to get a mining adventure going. But it turned out he realized his mission was to bring Theosophy to the West, to bring a meeting of the West and the East. That's why he sometimes has written articles to the Theosophist. Theosophy is neither Buddhism, nor Hinduism, nor this, nor that. It's the key.